Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Simone Riscala, and you are listening to the Endow Podcast, a conversation not just about the feminine genius in general, but about cultivating your particular feminine genius through the Catholic intellectual tradition and intentional community. Well, hello, Endow ladies. Simone here, and I'm with Professor Russell Hittinger. Welcome, Professor. How are you today?
Very good. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited to have you, especially because you were supposed to be one of the professors at the Tertio Millennio Seminar in 2019, and everybody was saying your favorite is going to be Professor Hittinger, and then you weren't there. So, bummer, but now I'm very happy to have this interview with you. So thank you so much for being with us, especially because we're going to release a Catholic social teaching Endow study. So I wanted to pick your brain, one of the best brains to pick on this, I know, about Catholic social teaching and talk to you about that. So there's a lot of things I want to talk to you about, but first, I'd like to ask you about, you know, how you got involved with Catholic social teaching. I know you have a book coming out. Is it coming out pretty soon, Professor?
The one that's coming out pretty soon is titled On the Dignity of Society, Collected Essays on Catholic Social.
Nice. I'm getting that. I'm going to get it. I can't wait. So tell me then, because one of the things that we wanted with the Endow study is to not have it start at Rerum Novarum, but to have more of like a bird's eye view of Catholic social teaching. So I'd love to hear your thoughts about that. But also, what's always kind of, you know, I've reflected on is that Catholic social teaching is part of moral theology. So I don't know if that's entirely clear to a lot of people that Catholic social teaching principles are born out of fundamental moral theology. So I kind of wanted to just say that so that people have kind of like a categorical framework for like where to place Catholic social teaching. It's not this like random collection of teachings, but it's actually grounded in theology, in moral theology. So I'd love to hear a little bit about your story of how you got into all of this, but also to hear about why does Catholic social teaching not just start with Rerum Novarum and Leo XIII?
Well, you know, it wasn't formally placed under moral theology until the pontificate of John Paul II.
No way.
See, no, this tradition went on for 150 years before anyone decided to place it somewhere.
Why is that? That doesn't make
because
sense.
Because from the very beginning, it was kind of, we would call it interdisciplinary. It has to, like your Endow study guide has it right. The thing is, the Catholic understanding of the restoration of society, of being right with our neighbor and with God. So I guess those are the two great commandments, and it would come under moral theology. But from the beginning, it had to do with legal things. It had to do with political things. Only later did it have to do with economic things, late 19th century. But so it was philosophical, it was theological, and no one knew quite where to put it. And if you had gone to a Roman university, even during the pontificate of Leo XIII, I mean, there wouldn't have been a place in the Gregorian University in Rome in the catalog for this subject.
Wow.
And in fact, even in Catholic universities, if you had gone to Marquette or Notre Dame or Fordham or wherever, I mean, as late as post-World War II period, no one quite knew where to put it.
Wow. That's so fascinating. Why John Paul II's pontificate? Because he wrote Gentes?
I think that gets ahead of the story a bit, but because he thought that the integrity of Catholic social teaching was getting scattered in too many different directions. And since he was the one who issued the very first papal encyclical ever on moral theology called Veritatis Splendor.
Yes.
Since he was firming that area of theology up, he said, well, we're going to put Catholic social doctrine as a subsidiary of that.
Wow.
So, that's my guess. So.
That makes sense. And I think that's kind of why, again, I don't obviously have all the knowledge that you do, but in reconciling Catholic social teaching within myself, I thought, well, I have to put it somewhere. Wouldn't it go mm-hmm. under morals? So I didn't even know all this history. And that's so fascinating to me. And I kind of want to go on a thought tangent, but anyway, so that's very, very interesting, that he did that. And I think it gives it, I don't know, credibility, would you say, like kind of, he's trying to place it under like, these are like, relativism is not a thing. Consequentialism is not a thing. Like these are intellectual heresies. There is truth. And the way that we think about our relationships also have to be grounded in these fundamental truths.
Right. And also, the evangelical commission to the church by Christ has been understood as being able to teach on faith and morals. I mean, that's right in the Code of Canon Law. Church yeah. has competence to teach on faith and morals, chiefly on faith, because that's the apostolic commission, is to preach to all nations.
Right.
The belief in Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. But morals, because those are like in the Ten Commandments, and Jesus had moral teachings, and there's, of course, the natural law.
Mm-hmm.
So to put it under moral theology is a reasonable move. But it's amazing how much of the tradition unfolded before they put it anywhere.
That is so fascinating. So tell me your story of how you got involved in this because I think that was something that our director of content, Laura, wanted to avoid. She wanted to avoid people thinking that CST mm-hmm. like magically shows up with Leo.
Right. Well, when I first started studying this seriously, which was not at the beginning of my career, but maybe midway, I immediately formed a judgment that is still pretty firm in my mind, that I don't approach Catholic social thought or doctrine on a topical basis. Like, well, there's our position on labor unions. There's our position on abortion. There's our position on world peace. There's our position on the right of all peoples to clean water. And, the list gets longer and longer.
Right.
These things. I don't look at it that way. I look at it as a kind of wisdom about social order, both as it's understood theologically and as it's understood morally. And you get to the list of issues later. Anyway, so the way I stumbled into that, I was doing some research for a book on Catholic understandings of the modern state, which means post-1789, after the French Revolution. And so I took some, I was on a sabbatical, and I took some time to read Leo XIII. And I read a couple of encyclicals, including Rerum Novarum, and I instantly formed the impression I should read more. And so I put aside everything I was to get done that year. It was a full academic year. In fact, I was at Notre Dame on sabbatical.
Wow.
And I figured out I should start reading in the 18th century, actually, 1700s.
Right.
And I just got up every day, and for about 5, 6, 7 hours would go through every encyclical, and I'd make a judgment, does this pertain to anything having to do with social order?
Right.
And I just make notes. And I was amazed to find out how much development there actually was by the time Leo became Pope in 1878. So I would say the main cause of modern Catholic social thinking is the French Revolution.
Wow.
It doesn't begin in economics. Only later, 19th century.
That's an important thing to know.
Yeah. And for this reason, when that revolution happened in France in 1789, the most important Catholic country in the world, France, its entire social order was swept away very quickly. So the monarchy was abolished. Soon thereafter, the king and the royal family were killed, executed. The first law of non-fault divorce was passed.
Wow.
And during the French Revolution, indeed. No fault meaning that you didn't have to show harm.
Wow.
Yeah. All you had to show was consent of both to,
very
or of one.
Very interesting.
It also passed a law making solemn religious vows not only illegal, but illegal under criminal law. It was actually a crime to take a solemn religious vows. Monasteries, religious houses were closed. Clergy had to go into the pulpit and swear an oath of loyalty to the new government. So certain essentials of Catholic life, I would say, societies that are tied together by vows are abolished. So the king takes a vow to the kingdom. And in the coronation rite, the king actually puts on a ring and marries the realm.
Right.
So kingship is gone. Religious vows are gone. Matrimonial vows are flattened to the point of just being a mere contract.
Why does the criminal vows surprise me less than the no-fault divorce? I don't know why, but...
Well, liberty, equality, and fraternity, which means all social orders have to imitate the political regime of equality and liberty. And, you know, when people who take vows are not underscoring liberty, they're underscoring a loyalty rather than a liberty,
right,
and a loyalty to an institution, right? And so the culture of vows of the three necessary societies, which we can talk about later, it's marriage, which is the foundation of family, it's polity, and it's church. The vows of all three were abolished.
Wow.
And so a new social order was being built, and that revolution spread out of France to the rest of Europe and to the rest of the Catholic world in the New World. South America had one revolution after another imitating the French model. So Pope Pius VII, before he was Pope Pius VII, Pope Pius VII was eventually kidnapped by Napoleon and held in solitary confinement. But when he was Cardinal Archbishop of Imola in Italy, he had on a stationery. The revolution had broken out. Liberty, equality, and peace in our Lord Jesus Christ. So the key here is that the Catholic beef was on what they meant by fraternity.
Ooh.
They didn't like what was meant by fraternity because the revolutionary ideal of fraternity canceled out traditional social order, canceled out traditional fraternities. And so very slowly, by the way, the revolution petered out after about 20 years, and they tried to restore a monarchy that didn't work very well. And there were more revolutions in Europe. And it was Leo XIII now, you know, almost a century after. He becomes a pope almost a century after the French Revolution, given all of the turmoil throughout Europe. Remember, everywhere in Europe, they're imitating this revolution. So even the Italian government is trying to impose a one-way divorce. By the way, they didn't succeed, but they tried. And
Why didn't they? Do you have any?
Because Victor Emanuele, who was the king and was a kind of a figurehead king in the first laicist government of Italy, 1860s, he actually had second thoughts about it, that it wouldn't be good for Italy if people could get divorces very easily.
Wow. Maybe there's a grandma in there who...
Yeah. Well, I'd like to say that the wisdom of the Holy Spirit leading St. Peter to Rome, and that the See of Peter ends up in Rome, is that they will never think out on the family.
I just love
no matter what else is going through their minds.
Family. Yes, I love that. So it's interesting what you're saying is that Catholic social thought in a more, and correct me if I'm wrong, in a more formal way was a reaction or caused by this true revolution in the true sense of the word, of the French Revolution.
The true revolution. The
true revolution. And before that, we could say that there was obviously thinking about social order, but it wasn't in terms of, it wasn't brought out in the public square as a formal thing because it was.
Well, I can give you an example of that.
Yeah.
The Reformation era and Counter-Reformation was very traumatic to the Christian church. But it wasn't traumatic over social order, not very much of it. So Protestants, most Protestants desacramentalized marriage, but they didn't desacralize it.
Right.
I mean, no one on either side of the Reformation would have had an argument over it's one man and one woman professing before God. And
Right. Okay. It's the theological details as opposed to like the way that our culture actually exists together. Very, very great. That's a really helpful example. So, okay. So where have we left off then?
So it took a while. By the way, as I say, there's more revolution. And by the time Leo is elected, there is an economic crisis going on in Europe too, in which as much as 60% of the entire population of what would become Germany move from rural areas to urban centers for pick-me-up work in industry. This is not salary work. This is work by the hour and every day. Having to go down to the and getting pick-me-up jobs. And so social order is going haywire everywhere. And by the way, this is why the 19th century is the great era of the founding of social science. Durkheim, Marx, all of these great social thinkers arise in the 19th century because it was not just the Catholics who were alarmed, but actually almost everyone was alarmed. So by the time Leo's Pope, he devises a really interesting strategy to deal with this. And he said, there are three necessary societies. By the way, there's more than three, but there's three necessary, which means necessary for human flourishing. You're just not going to be happy without membership in these three.
Okay.
Of course, it's the domestic order, marriage, family. It's political order and it's ecclesial order. So he wants to say that we're not just political animals. We are matrimonial animals and we are also ecclesial animals. In fact, we're all three.
This is a logical progression, right?
Right.
You can't be in the political order well without your own little unit where you're living your day-to-day life, and then political square has to then be ordered to the spiritual reality of the ecclesial order. So this is brilliant. Now, are you saying like his strategy was then to take it out of kind of the not practical stuff, because there is practical stuff, but take it out of the practical, economical, like we're having this like industry change and how people work, and into like understanding that human flourishing starts here, and this is going to give us the flourishing framework to exist by which we can then make better judgments.
This is the philosophy of it.
Yes.
So to speak. And see, now here was what was brilliant about the strategy. I call it a scissors strategy. Because remember, the lowest order, which is the domestic order, is based on sacramental marriage. So the state is limited from above by a supernaturally founded entity called the church, and from below by sacramental marriage.
Oh, that's a great way.
It puts the state into a scissors, you see.
Oh, that's so brilliant.
Brilliant. And it worked so well with regard to being able to convey to a large number of people this concept, to understand this, that the popes kept on using it for a long time because it worked really well. So the state is limited from above and it's limited from below.
We're going to think about liberty like this with this framework. I love that. Genius.
And he used that in many of his encyclicals. And by the way, the encyclicals on this subject are not only just about economics, they're not just about politics either. I mean, they're about social order. So they could be about the social order of the church. He actually even has an encyclical on the social order of angelic choirs.
Oh my gosh.
Against the socialists. Why you can't reduce everything to one flat order.
Oh my gosh, what is the name of that? And I want to read it.
it's his very first encyclical against socialism. I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it's like within months of his election, 1878.
Oh, that's so neat. Okay, I'm going to look that up. Professor, I know you do all these fancy, lofty things, but you have like underground book clubs that, you know, one might want to join. So this is angelic choir, an encyclical on angelic choirs against the
So they were truly interested in Remember, this is the great era of liberalism too, classical liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
They were very interested in what is there besides the individual that has to be taken into account. And wherever that issue could get raised, whether it was marriage, family order, a huge issue was mandatory education. Mm-hmm. Because of all of the things that happened in the 19th century, or at least the Western 19th century, is mandatory education. It changed everything. Yeah. It deeply affected the family, and it deeply affected the church. To whom does the child belong?
Yeah.
To the polity, to the household, or to the church? And there was an Italian scholar who once said that if you start reading in mid-19th century, which is about when mandatory education starts kicking into gear,
mm-hmm.
and all you read was what the church had to say about marriage, family, and education, you wouldn't need to read anything else about Catholic social doctrine. You'd know the whole thing.
You'd know the whole thing, yeah.
Because those disputes were so multifaceted, including in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, the United States didn't have the problem with revolutions, constant revolutions, the way Western Europe did. But it was really hard for the Catholic Church in this country to work out a plan of what to do about education.
Yeah.
I mean, with regard to the public schools.
Right, right.
In fact, the school issue from 1870s until before World War I was a just humongous issue. The Catholic Church in this country solved it by simply building their own school system.
Right, exactly. And now that's a whole other podcast interview about education and Catholic education.
Right. What that means. Mandatory education changes society everywhere. For instance, it profoundly changed clerical and religious society. I mean, priests became much better educated.
Yes.
I mean, once the church had to take care of their own education,
right,
it changed what it meant to be a religious.
Right. Because it certainly wasn't going to be the state that determines what education is and allow that. But so I think the church solved that pretty creatively and well. But wow. Now, there's like 10 questions.
And so what happened is that there was a period of what we call the Great Coherency. In fact, this is a Vatican term. The Great Coherency is called the Leonine Era because six popes are either born or come of age with Leo. So, for example, Pius X, born 1835, Benedict XV, born 1854, Pius XI, born 1857, who was actually a student of Leo, Pius XII, born 1876, who was ordained in the last 3 years of Leo's pontificate, John XXIII, born 1881, and Paul VI, born 1897. So what Leo was working out was the matrix of six popes. I don't believe ever in church history has there been a cohort of popes so tightly connected through birth. Basically, we're talking about 2.5 generations.
Yeah.
And so they knew each other's minds.
Right.
Yeah.
That is incredible. That is incredible. So if someone wants to, I mean, we have this Endow study coming out. Where's your level of hope, I guess, as a kind of a different question on like Catholics really learning Catholic, like why is it important to study Catholic social thought? Especially when there's such a huge endeavor, like, you know, you're talking about your sabbatical and reading all these things. Why is it important? Is it important in a sense, or, you know, of the important things, what should Catholics be focusing on? I don't know if you're like catching all the articles out there and, you know, I try to stay not so half plugged in, half plugged out, because otherwise I can't learn anything. If I'm so into what's being said out there, then I can't really learn all the good stuff.
Yeah.
Do the good things. But, you know, that Catholic social thought is going to be like the great healer. You know, Endow is bigger than the United States, but like, you know, there's all this conversation about Catholic social teaching being that like healing bridge building of our polarized culture. And I thought it was, I had caught your talk, your brief talk on Catholic social teaching through Lumen Christi, and learned from that talk about the Mariology involved in Catholic social teaching. And I thought what was so kind of providential, I'd like to say, about our curriculum at Endow is that our Rosary study came out last year, and then our Catholic social teaching study will come out this year. And just, and then to hear you talk about how you can't ignore Mary and all of this, I thought, oh, this is great, because we didn't actually do that on purpose. So, what are your thoughts on all of that?
I would say to put in first place the learning of the tradition organically before you jump into it as a policy thing.
Yes. Amen. Yeah.
So, you know, one of the ironies of this is that once upon a time, social teachings were called civil, doctrina civilis or civilis, because they just assumed everything is kind of making an orbit around the state. I mean, this is before the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. And by early 20th century, they started using the term doctrina socialis. Now, why did they use the term social? I think precisely in order that people not fall into the rut of making everything a set of policies about the state.
Right. Yes. That is
social order does not begin with the state.
Right.
And but in our period of time, I'm afraid to say that people, when an encyclical comes out that's called a social encyclical, and by the way, what's called a social encyclical, according to the press, is not the only stamp of approval of something being a social teaching. Mm-hmm. Social teaching is more than what the New York Times are telling it.
Yes.
There's a lot deeper and more multifaceted.
Yeah, and it just gets reduced to politics, which it's not.
It's reduced to politics right away, and we all know what happens. Catholics on various sides
just use social teaching for their own.
Yeah, I know. That's exactly what's going on. Everyone knows it, too.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think for our Endow women, like, especially because we're dedicated to education, true education is not a political organization. This is a Catholic apostolate. Actually, we have a juridic person in canon law. I thought you might care. I don't think many people care, but I thought you might be the sort of person that would care. And so a true education of maybe there'll be women who are those women. You know, it's very easy to become moralistic and ideological no matter how much you rail against it, right? But to have these injustices actually be these encounters and these moments of an authentic education and coming down to what you were saying about like studying this organically and putting all of the reactivity and the polarization, the biases, and seeing things through the lens of the New York Times or whoever, and coming as an ordinary Christian and trying to understand our faith and our history and our tradition and just the depth of it, as you know, anybody listening to this podcast will notice.
Well, you know, in Rerum Novarum, what are the new things that Leo is worrying about from the title of the encyclical? Well, the spirit of revolutionary change. Everyone is consumed to know via newspapers and telegraphs back then what's new. The irony is that's how people treat papal encyclicals now, is they're only as good as you can find out what's new. You see, I mean, it's, and of course, the irony would be lost on 99.9% of the people reading it because they don't know the history of it. But the first thing to look for is not what's new, but what's coherent. I mean, what's going on here? So, for example, on the subject of what's new, since the Council of Trent's canons on matrimony, they had doctrinal canons on matrimony, and they had disciplinary canons on matrimony. All those centuries go by, it was three centuries, until there was a formal papal teaching on matrimony, and that's Leo the 13th, and it's 1880, Arcanum Divinae. It may even be his most important encyclical.
Wow!
Because it's truly a social encyclical. He gets right down to what makes this society a true society, what differentiates it from other societies. It's called Arcanum Divinae, which was followed by his own students. Reprise. Pius XI did a reprise of Arcanum Divinae in 1930, and it's called Casti Connubii.
Yes.
And that's also a social encyclical. And by the way, since 1930, it's the last one standing. Most people don't know this. There hasn't been a formal pontifical teaching on matrimony since 1930. Wow. So what's new? What's new is 1880 and 1930. You just have to look back a ways.
So wait, is that why Costi Canubi is like the famous one? Because it's the last one? How come I've never heard about the Leo one?
Oh, the Leo one's crucial because, it's the first in almost 100 years.
I mean, I'm like medium in the nerd barometer maybe. But
he gets really right down to questions of social order in this. I mean, you can learn a huge amount about social order rightly apprehended by beginning with Arcanum Divinae, and then skip ahead and read Costi Canubi, because other problems come into view by the 1920s, the state's intervening in it more than marriage, more than in family, more than ever. Wow. Because it's Mussolini time in Italy, for example.
Yeah.
But so you want to read these because you're not just learning about matrimony, you're learning about what family is, you're learning about what education is, you're learning about what the relationship between the domestic unit and the church is, you're learning about the state. By the way, it's in Costi a fantastic analysis of why physical and social sciences, as they understood them in the 1920s, were entirely insufficient for understanding matrimonial and domestic order. So, I mean, these are truly, these things have philosophical heft to them.
Yep, which is why we need to study and not, I mean, the more you study, the more you realize how much you don't know. And how, I mean, reading an encyclical is one of the most frustrating things. And that's what we do at Endow. We read papal mm-hmm. documents. But, you know, you look at the footnotes and go, well, if I'm, I need to go back. And I need to keep going back and back and back. So, well, that's amazing. How has this is a question from Laura, our director of content. How has this changed you besides just giving you this whole other, you know, aspect of your personal vocation as an intellectual? But has it, you know, maybe this is a too personal question, Professor, but has it changed you? If so, how has it changed you? What do you say about that?
Well, it's made me much more historically conscious.
Yeah.
Of modern Catholic history, tracking this.
Tracking stuff.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And not just coming up with a big idea and making the facts fit it, but looking at the facts.
And seeing the patterns.
Seeing the patterns. I think one problem that people encounter, no matter how educated they are, is what I call the problem of giganticism. That when we talk about society, well, like, which one are you talking about? You see, we talk about like there's just this one big thing called society, or the adjective social just modifies one big thing.
Right.
And
right.
We talk about social changes. We talk gigantically all the time. I mean, that's the way the United Nations talks. That's the way they talk at Davos.
Yeah.
Right. That's the way big corporations talk. But
No one's really communicating because we don't know what we're actually talking about.
Or what we're gesturing toward is human sociability in some large way, and the way we in a global world kind of affect one another. But what they're not talking about precisely is what it's like to be a member, a part of a social whole, of a concrete society, like your family or your marriage, or your county, or your nation, right? Or which church? So to see things from inside the perspective of being a member in a concrete society. So when I think of sociability, I can think of people going to the opera, right? And it's wonderfully sociable, right? There's a kind of electricity in the crowd, and, but you're not in a society, right?
Right, right, right.
Okay. So too much of our thought these days are gigantic thoughts, and it has to do with everything from climate change to first world, third world. But first world, third world are not two societies. You got to get down to the ground.
Yeah,
that's what changed my way of thinking about things, because I'm very interested in little questions like who belongs to whom and what kind of promises did they have to make to one another to hold themselves out as one? And how long do they intend for this to last? And what's the difference between a motorcycle club and a parish?
Yeah, those are the actual big questions. And they're the questions that dominate our ordinary life. And if we can understand that very clearly and live that very clearly, then I think we're better suited to then make those bigger judgments. Why, like, a true education is so important. That's so fascinating. I imagine you're, this is just me making things up, so you can correct me, but I imagine you became so much happier studying Catholic social teaching in this, like, profile. First, it's like such a huge privilege to have had that sabbatical and that time to read through and make all these amazing discoveries. And then share it with people like me and everybody else listening that, you know, just so is so incredible to pick it up. Do you feel like you have I imagine that you'd have like a very prophetic voice, just looking back at history and looking at the patterns to see like what's coming next with our social. So any prophetic words you want to share with us, especially Catholic women? I mean, endowed women are, you know, faithful daughters of the magisterium and want to learn. And many of us have felt, you know, robbed of an education, just even basic catechesis. I mean, that's kind of where we're at. So what would you have to say just to the ordinary endowed women who's really interested in these things and wants to study?
Well, you know, I think the lesson that Pope Leo a century ago was so interested in conveying still the main one, which is that early 20th century, globalized, electronically connected, right? Mm-hmm. Someone's probably listening to us right now and we haven't even posted it yet.
Creepy.
We're connected like all get out.
Yeah.
And so the social options are multiplied and multiplied and multiplied, right? You call people friends on Facebook and then you don't call them friends.
Yeah.
Voluntary associations are much more within the reach of ordinary people than they would have been, let's say, in 1810. Voluntary associations are there to form friendships and then to dissolve them and to move on to others, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So part of the problem of the contemporary world is a superabundance of choice with regard to even something as simple as rectifying our loneliness. I mean, so where do you even begin, right? Okay, so.
Well, yeah, now you're making me think about that is exactly the like source of our loneliness, all these immense a pollution of voluntary associations when the three necessary societies are not reflected on and not thought about, not lived richly and not lived well.
That's right. Because, you know, social capital theorists, which are somewhat in demand today, they call social capital this. It's an analysis of how many different societies or groups you belong to. And as you belong to more and more, let's say, Boy Scout troop, bowling club, and your motorcycle club.
Right.
You build up social capital. You build up social capital. But the problem is that's very questionable capital. And I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
The sociologists, they're economic sociologists, at Princeton, Case and Deaton, 2 years ago came out with a very highly publicized study on the mortality and morbidity rates of undereducated white males in the United States, whose morbidity and mortality rates were just off the map.
Wow. Okay.
And they were trying to correlate, like, what are the factors? I mean, there are factors like they're not at work. They're playing video games at home at the age of 35 years old. Factors like drug addiction, to be sure. Factors like an enormous population who had been in prison gets released. Right. They don't know what to do. But the steadiest factors were three. If this is just correlation, not causality now, but the correlation.
Correlation.
Okay, the extremely vulnerable will have this in common. Their marriages have flopped, and every time they try to do them again, they flop again, and their family relations are in tatters, and they've dropped out of their churches and any religious. You know, the biggest decline in our country from church going is not millennial atheists. It's 40-year-old undereducated white males who don't go to their Methodist church anymore. So first of all, it's the family coming apart. They don't want anything to do with it. Every time they do it, it's a bigger mess than it was before. They drop out of church. And the third one is this. They're alarmingly angry at every political authority, beginning with the mayor.
Because everybody's fault.
But these are the three necessary societies, right? So, so you may go out and join a club.
Right.
But social order, to be right with other human beings socially and not be a somewhat successful participant in these three necessary societies is doomed.
It's doomed and it won't matter. And we have all the statistics out there. We have these things called like the epidemic of loneliness. We have all this. So yeah, that's simple.
In the old days, they were called necessary. This was kind of taken out of Aristotle, who said about political order, it begins in necessity, but ends in excellence, by which he meant that a community would create political order first, because if they don't, they're just going to kill each other.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, question of justice is going to have to be solved like Hatfields and McCoys if you don't have political order. Yeah. But as you begin to learn to have political order, all kinds of excellences come into view. Kinds of justice you never considered before. Kinds of harmony you never. Great human projects. Mm-hmm. The extension of education. Well, every one of the necessary societies begins in that kind of necessity. You just really need it. So in marriage, man and woman need one another to procreate.
Yeah.
Or they did once upon a time.
Yeah.
But there's the need of companionship. There's the need of family. But once you start doing it, other excellences are developed. Other excellences come into view. And same with church. It begins in a necessity. It's called salvation, forgiveness of sins. Okay.
Yeah.
But it becomes something as great as the cathedral at Chartres.
Yeah.
So necessary societies transcend their first necessity. And the bond becomes a hub of other human perfections, you see.
And creativity and basically Western civilization at some point developed out of that, out of the monasteries, out of these necessary societies where human flourishing allowed for these rich, like you were saying, these other voluntary societies. But they're richer all the more because of it. So we have to get back to basics, which seems to be kind of the theme in my conversations with my friends from, 2020 and last year, and just looking at what's really essential and trying to live the essential very well in a confused culture, in a confused world that's becoming. I was really struck by what you were saying about, these big questions, the United Nations, and we talk about society, but which society you're talking about. I've personally felt the frustration of feeling like I don't even know how to communicate with anybody anymore because I don't know that we're even starting in the same place anymore. And so that's just made it even more lonely because you don't even feel like you have people to talk to. Like you're talking about the same thing, but you're not even talking about the same thing. Everybody's starting from a different, it seems anyway, a different place.
To add on to that, with the decline of ecclesial membership and with the decline of matrimonial domestic.
Yeah.
You know what happens? Everyone puts all of their eggs in the basket of politics, which is a kind of insanity.
Insanity and also really boring, in my humble opinion.
But the passions of wanting, having an honorable, stable social life is a natural inclination.
Yeah.
To be right with others. But we've knocked out the ecclesial one. We've greatly diminished the domestic one. So now it all depends on politics. Mm-hmm. And once there's a disagreement,
you're
has
out.
To be Yeah, you have to fight to the end.
Yeah, it's violent. You're canceled. Yeah. It's all of that. Whew, big things. This was so pleasant. Okay, I have two more questions for you. Well, maybe one of them is a little bit unfair, but what could the church be doing better? And I know we're form historically, and the church comes through the laity and lay apostolates, you know, and all of that. But is there something that we can, I mean, I don't know, maybe I take back my question. You can answer if you want. Maybe there's just like no easy answer to it. Obviously there's no easy answer to it, but if you had some inspirations about, especially for the women listening. And then also I think, if you wanted to say a few words about paying attention to Mary and how, because when I learned that from you about Catholic social teaching and Marian apparitions and her role, I immediately thought about my own family in Egypt, where Mary would appear in Zaytun, in this district in Cairo. And every time she did, everybody was like, oh shoot, a church is going to get bombed. Like you're, you know, and that's what, you know, ended up happening. So, I immediately connected that with what you were
saying. Well, historically speaking, there are two devotions, actually going back to the 17th century, 18th century, that have always been interwoven in Catholic social thinking. The first is the cult of the Sacred Heart, St. Margaret Mary. You know, that became a fighting issue that the Catholic resistance to the revolutions almost was always under the sign of the Sacred Heart. And all the way to 1898, when Leo XIII had a tumor on his back and he prayed to the Sacred Heart for relief, and it turned out to be benign. Anyway, they got it out.
Wow.
It was the first time a pope had gone under general anesthesia, as I recall the story. Anyway, and for the Jubilee of 1900, he dedicated the world to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And in it, in this, it's called Quas Primas. Not Quas Primas. What's the name of that encyclical? It is Annum Sacrum. And he dedicated the human race to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And he said, here on out, the person who will deliver the church from its troubles will be Christ, who is on the yoke of Caesar's. We're no longer going to count on Constantine's coming along.
Oh.
Yeah. And the other cult is Marian. So, in the 19th century, you will, if you go and just look at the list of encyclicals, you will see encyclicals on rosary and public life. A very prominent one is called Bie Benotto. It's Italy, 1887, Pope Leo XIII. And it's basically on why the humility of Mary will teach us how to be good social members. But see, Mary goes all the way back to early centuries of the church as the Salus Populi. Like if Rome has a COVID-19 pandemic or something mm-hmm. like that, mm-hmm. they always pray to Mary for the happiness and salvation of the people,
right.
as being the protector of the city,
right.
and so forth. This was kind of formalized by John Paul II. So if you look at John Paul II's many encyclicals, especially those that touch on social order, you will see that after he says what he wants to say, the last section is always to consider everything in the light of Mary. I think Pope Francis has continued that tradition.
Yes, because it seems to me that the ones I read always end with Mary. Benedict mm-hmm. did that. Just awesome. Well, gosh, I guess our time's up. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us for all these women that are excited to study Catholic social teaching and start that journey? And last year, we had a Holy Spirit conference, was part of the Dharna project with Poland that Father Maciej Dieba encouraged us to be a part of. And we kind of dedicated this Holy Spirit conference to John Paul II's centenary for his birthday and for his work in Catholic social thought and calling upon the Holy Spirit to help our country during you know, what was a difficult year and continues to be a difficult time. So any last words before we say goodbye? And I've enjoyed this conversation so much, took tons of notes. Can't wait to learn more from you.
Well, okay. my last point on the subject of Mary, you know, that when John Paul II was elected, exactly 100 years after Pope Leo, he sketched out his coat of arms as Pope. And he doesn't have any of the traditional stuff in there. He doesn't have cannonballs and penguins, and, you know, like Papa Ratzinger had a bear in his. But no, he doesn't have the traditional kind of signs of ability to rule.
Right.
And what he has is a simple Latin cross, off-centered. And underneath the transept of the cross, he has the M for Mary, standing at the foot of the cross.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
He's just the best, right? John Paul II, he's just amazing. So we'll take that. We'll take our rosaries with us to our Endow group meeting. So thank you so much, Professor. This was just awesome. I hope that you come back on the Endow podcast. We have so much to learn from you and so grateful for all of your work.
Okay. It's good to have me. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. If this episode was helpful for you, please consider sharing it with a friend or two. We would also appreciate it so much if you left a rating and review so that more women can discover Endow and our mission to help women cultivate their unique feminine genius. Please also check out the link below to learn how to become a monthly donor to help defray podcast production costs. And, of course, if you'd like to talk to me about joining or starting your own Endow group, please email me at simone.rascala@endowgroups.org. And remember, you are the heart of Endow.